The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I felt like he was embarrassed that his son, that he had been so proud of, who had been a commercial lawyer, you know exactly what you might hope for from your son, was now doing injury cases, you know?
Dale Swope talks about the early days, starting a now 40-year-old law firm from scratch, right out of law school, and the love he found practicing bad faith law.
We're the only thing that stands between our client and Medicaid. We are the only thing that separates those who are going to have a meaningful, fulfilled life with the money that they need to be able to take care of themselves from a lifetime of public assistance and bed sores. It's just us. And if that doesn't make you feel like a damn hero, if that doesn't make you love your job, you got deeper problems, man, because this is a dream job.
And his concerns about law becoming a mere commodity as some law firms turn into mass volume settlement operations.
And what the hell do you want to be? Do you want to be a trial lawyer, or do you want to be an insurance adjuster with a freaking law degree? Because that's what they'll turn you into. They'll turn you into a lawyer that shuffles around papers and moves things back and forth and kisses up to the insurance company and ends up taking what they're willing to pay you. Is that really what you want? It isn't.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Dale Swope jokes that he'll pay $1,000 to anyone that can prove they've been more broke than he's been. He had to take losing cases no one else would touch and find a way to win them. He did, including his first personal injury case, a case that he never dreamt he would face. Along the way, he not only made a living, but has built a vibrant law practice from the ground up that today has 11 lawyers, with its office in a remodeled old Tampa brewery. He is a recent past president of the Florida Justice Association and is in the Eagle Hall of Fame for his lifetime of contributions. He's a recipient of the Mickey Smiley Award for Mentorship. In fact, it was through the FJA and a special mentor that Dale Swope saw an opportunity to create a niche practicing bad faith law. Dale Swope sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in May of 2019 to talk about his love of courtroom battle, breaking the money cycle, and building and running a law firm that he has designed to survive him.
Dale, you're a Tampa native, graduate of Hillsborough High School, University of South Florida, Florida law school grad. You started this firm 6 months after graduation from law school. Why?
Well, that's a question I probably need a couch for to be able to answer it accurately. I'd come out of law school at a time when the cycle was that there were no jobs, and I was grateful and fortunate to get a job down in Palm Beach. I worked with a man named Ronnie Sales, who now we would know him as David Sales' dad. And so David Sales is a great cigarette lawyer out of the Searcy firm, and formerly out of the Searcy firm. And so I went down there, and he was a great man, great lawyer. We had great cases. Heck, I represented Ted Nugent's wives. I represented Mrs. Weyerhaeuser. I represented everybody. But it felt very artificial to me to be in that world of Palm Beach. I was surrounded by a bunch of rich people, and I am not one, and it didn't feel right. It didn't feel like anybody there was authentic. It didn't feel like they understood what work was, and that's really been an important element of my life since I can remember. So I came home one time with a group of lawyers. We came here for a deposition, and while we were here, the lawyers from Palm Beach were all like, "Dang, Dale, why did you leave this place?" And I realized that I didn't have a good answer for him. I came back here with the intention of finding a job. I quit after about 5 months. I quit actually three separate times, and Ronnie kept giving me pay raises. And finally, the third time, I said, Ronnie, it's not the money. I love you. I was the highest paid person in my law school class by that time, but it wasn't the money. I just wanted to come home, and I felt like he made it look so easy in the same way that Willie Mays makes catching outfield balls look easy. Ronnie made it look like it was easy, so I felt like I could do it myself. So I came back here. I did not get a job, and I went from being an unemployed lawyer to a self-employed lawyer, and I've been unemployed ever since.
You were a trailblazer for the entrepreneurs since you.
You know, necessity is the mother of invention, isn't it?
Now, since then, you've established yourself as literally the guy who takes cases no one else will take and figures out a way to win them. How did you come to that? Because you started in civil litigation when you started your firm, right?
I started out as an unemployed lawyer. And so I went where I could find things that would help me build a firm. And so that was first working with all the small businesses that I had some connection to, and I would do the cases that nobody else wanted. I'd do their collections on percentage fees and work with them, and I had to take cases that nobody else wanted because that's what was available to me. And so I needed to learn how to win those cases. But if I'm honest, that was a singularly unsatisfying line of work. I was 7 or 8 years, five or six years into being a lawyer. I was doing a lot of commercial work. I was good at it. I became board certified in that field. I was given seminars to people, you know, for the Florida Bar and all of that. But the fact of the matter is, when you're working for big corporations or medium corporations, you become a vendor to them. You're not a whole heck of a lot different from their insurance salesman or their photocopy repairman, and you're just part of the enterprise that makes them go further. And so the opportunity came for me to handle a personal injury trial, and I did, and I decided that that's where I would put my idea. Now, I never have advertised. I still don't advertise. It's a principle of our firm that we will not be on television or billboards or bench stops, any of those things. And so because of that, you kind of got to not figure there's going to be a zillion cases coming through. You got to kind of take the cases you have and find a way to win them.
That first personal injury case, though, was a biggie.
It was.
Tell us about that.
Well, the man who was hurt was in his 20s, and he was kind of the third generation of his family's roofing business. And he was on the roof one day on a Saturday with a crew on a warehouse, and they had gotten this brand new piece of machinery. And you use hot asphalt to build a roof, or you did back in those days. Hot asphalt was 425 degrees. And this machine was a weird design machine that you really, to look at it, couldn't figure out how to use it. And it came with no instructions. The manufacturer later told us that salesman was supposed to stay and show you how to use it, and the salesman didn't do that. Some kind of snafu happened. And so this kid is up on the roof doing his best to figure it out with an actual production crew around him, and he is walking backwards with it, which he shouldn't have been doing, but that's no other way to figure it out. And as he's walking backwards, he steps right off the edge of the roof, and he falls down about 18 feet, landed on his head, fractured his jaw and his skull, injured his brain. And then the machine comes down, and the machine weighs 600 pounds, and it lands on his chest, and it crushed his chest. The men from the roof ran down, and when they found him, he was covered in this hot asphalt that was congealing in his mouth and in his nose, and so they had to clear a breathing passage for him. And who knows how long it was that he couldn't breathe, but he was just scalded with this hot asphalt. And so it came to me, and we were looking into it, and I could see that it was wrong that they had delivered this machine in that way. I could see that he was operating, and he backed off the roof. but it felt like there ought to be something that could be done for him. No lawyer that I knew would take the case, though. I went to all the big names in Tampa, and they were very kind to me in telling me that there just was not a case there. So I was left with the idea of either dropping the case or handling it myself. And the, as you know, the injured person, the plaintiff, was my brother. And
oh my goodness.
So
that's not one you could drop.
No, we took the case, and it was a funny thing. You know, my dad's always been a huge important part of my life, and my dad knew the manufacturer of that machinery. He knew everybody because he's been in the roofing business for generations. And so we were suing friends of his, and I felt like he was embarrassed that his son, that he had been so proud of, who had been a commercial lawyer, you know, exactly what you might hope for from your son, was now doing injury cases, you know. It was a funny thing because I was a grown man by then, but an apartment didn't open up that I was going to move into. Somehow or the other, I ended up living at my parents' home during this dang trial. And every morning I would get up and, man, I can't believe I'm still choked up by that. Every morning I'd get up and leave before daybreak to get to the office. I was a solo practitioner. I had no associates. I'm trying this case against three major law firms.
And this is really your first
ever
personal injury.
In retrospect, it's pathetic. You know, my graphic exhibits were 8x10 photos that I stuck on a poster board with push pins. And, you know, they just, in retrospect, they ran circles around me. But I had the truth, you know, and I just held on to that. And
well, it's your brother, too.
It's my brother, but I felt like my dad was ashamed of me. And then he would come, and he would sit in the back, and he would watch the trial. And by the time we were done, I gave my closing argument, which was, again, maybe not my greatest. I ran out of time and so on, but when we were done, my dad walked over to me and he said, "You know something, I think at least now they understand why we sued them." And when he said "we," that's the first time he was ever part of the team. And so when the verdict came out, the verdict was really good. It was big. And
wow.
We won that case and we won the appeal, and it changed my brother's life. He's my brother, FYI, is doing really well now. He's got good. Two great kids and grandkids, and he lives in a big house up in Saddlebrook, and he's had a fabulous life since then, and I think that maybe I helped.
That's amazing that he even survived.
It is. And he is a strong man, my brother is, and he's overcome all of it.
I know you've transitioned to other fields, but how do you figure out, that's a very unique marketing position for, there's lots of potential cases that no one else wants.
Yeah.
How do you judge what you can do if you can help? Is it sometimes just a feel or an instinct versus the apparent strength of the case or the apparent lack of strength of the case?
You know, we joke around here that we have built our firm out of other people's garbage cans because we took all these cases that nobody else wanted. Because if you don't advertise, the only place you're going to get cases are from other lawyers. And the only cases you're going to get from other lawyers are the ones that they don't want, right? And so I just started looking for what that niche might be that we could fill. And the only way you're going to do that is by working harder, studying more, taking fewer cases, trying to get everything out of every case that you handle. And that's who we kind of became. And so when we look at a case now, honestly, if I feel in my gut that there is a fundamental injustice here, I don't want to rest and I don't want to sleep until there's a way. And the thing that happens on many cases, the worst cases are the ones where somebody has been horrifically injured and it isn't their fault. It's somebody else's fault, clearly. But there's no source to pay for the damages. And that happens all the time. And every lawyer that's ever practiced knows the misery of that feeling. You meet with the clients and you tell them, and they're wondering, why can't we take this guy's car out of his driveway? They're asking questions like that, and it's just not feasible. And, you know, you feel like you're a failure, that you don't know what to do. I had that feeling, and then one day I was in an FJA seminar. It was the academy back then, of course, and I'm sitting on the second row. I've paid my good money for this dang seminar, so I'm going to get every minute out of it. And a man spoke named Lefferts Mabee Jr. And he was an unusual fellow. He caught my attention. He was a phenomenal speaker, and he told me how to solve that problem. And it was through this law of bad faith. And I felt like the scales had been removed from my eyes. I felt like I could breathe again. I felt like I was a foot taller than I had been. I could see immediately. I think maybe even more than other people could see. And this gets a little deep in the woods here, but the situation is this. With insurance bad faith, insurance companies in these horrible cases are often willing to pay the policy limits. That's not the issue. The issue is they don't want to do anything else. They want to move on to some other case where they can save themselves a little bit of money. In these cases, they're not going to save any money, and so they don't want to invest any time into it. Well, if you're the insured customer, this is the one you hope your insurance company will pay attention to. So
that's why you pay insurance.
That's why we buy insurance, is for that protection. Well, I had come into this injury field from the background of being a commercial lawyer. I was used to doing things like reading contracts, every word. I was used to doing things like being careful about a release. If my client's going to sign something, I would pay attention to it. I understood deadlines. I understood contract law and the contractual relationships. That was a foreign concept to these people in personal injury. So when we started asking insurance company to do some essential core things in addition to paying their policy limits, they thought I was an idiot and they would never do it. And so we had a string working with Left Maybe. We had a string of about 70 cases that we successfully were able to find failures by the insurance companies that ultimately resulted in recoveries to our clients for their full damages. People with brain injuries and deaths and amputations and spinal cord injuries and burns, all the worst of these injuries, all these people who had been turned away from lawyers, seen three lawyers, four lawyers, they had all heard the same thing. They could come to me, they could come to us, and working with Left, we could make these things full recoveries. And that, if I was unfulfilled in my practice before, if I wasn't sure what I was doing, now I knew exactly what I was doing. And that's the lawyer that I always wanted to be. Ever since Key's case, when that verdict came out in Key's case, in the case that nobody else in town would take, that one came to me and we succeeded. I said, this is all I want to do. And then the relationship with Left Maybe, Bob Mays, Young Left, Lou Rosenblum, those are great people that kind of helped me in my path to doing that.
And you've made quite a niche for yourself ever since then, focusing for the most part on insurance bad faith.
That is our gig. That's our jam right there. And there's nothing quite like it, because it's every single bit of it. Not only are you helping wonderful people who are deserving when nobody else knows how to help them, we recognize that in most of these cases, we're the only thing that stands between our client and Medicaid. We are the only thing that separates those who are going to have a meaningful, fulfilled life with the money that they need to be able to take care of themselves from a lifetime of public assistance and bed sores. It's just us. And if that doesn't make you feel like a damn hero, if that doesn't make you love your job, you got deeper problems, man, because this is a dream job.
It's got to be tremendously satisfying, and see it in your eyes. What made you want to be a lawyer growing up here in Tampa?
Well, that's a funny question. I don't know that I ever really did. And whenever I thought I wanted to be a lawyer, I thought I wanted to be a banker's lawyer. I wanted to be a guy on Wall Street who would sit around and make deals with people and service the banking rich man's industry. And I don't. It was in law school that I began to realize that arguing was more fun than just being a service provider. And in the early days of my practice, I realized that I was having a better time. I enjoyed the process of winning. Hell, I enjoy losing better than doing nothing. I could never just do that. I don't think I could do it. Right now, when we have to do, there's always contract work that you have to do in the practice of law or running a law firm. I'd rather be shot than work on a dang contract, you know? And so it was a morph, but I slowly came to realize. And then I learned something. Only a few years ago, I learned something. And it's I learned my dad, who was a kid of the Depression, had gone into the military because World War II was going on. As soon as he could turn 18, he went into the Army, and the war ended. And he came out of school, came out of the Army, met my mom, fell in love, and it was his intention, and he never knew this, he never told me this, it was his intention to go to law school and become a lawyer. And when I learned that, I said, Dad, why didn't you ever mention that to me? And he said, I didn't want to influence you. You know, of course I wanted you to be a lawyer, but I didn't want to tell you that because then you'd feel like you had to. He says, but when you chose that path, naturally, you know, I felt like it was in your dang genes or something. He didn't get to go because my mom ended up pregnant. All pregnancies were unplanned in 1950. My mom ended up pregnant, and he had to quit school in order to support his family.
Sure, but,
maybe it's in my genes.
What were the most important influences growing up for you, especially those that have guided your career in law?
Growing up, maybe it was that, but my family, we're small businessmen, small business people. My grandfather had a restaurant and a roofing company, and my dad joined that roofing company, and my mother started a travel agency, and we have just always been sort of people who made our own way by work. And that influence fell to me that I just am more comfortable working than not working. If somebody wants to talk to me about work-life balance, I mean, I hear that term and I understand what people mean, and I think what they mean by saying I need a greater work-life balance is they mean I need to work less hours. That's what they really are saying, and they don't want to, trying to find some euphemism by saying I want to work less and do other things more. I grew up in a family where we were a small business, and the business phone rang. It had an extension, so it would ring in our kitchen, so my dad would never miss the opportunity. And we all learned at an early age how to answer that phone professionally, so it would sound like we were being answered at a business. And we all understood that even during dinner, whatever it was, business had to come first. We had to, not that we were trying to get rich. My dad wasn't trying to get rich. He just didn't want us to be poor. That's sunk to me. So I think my idea of balance, I would use the term integration. I want you to do a job that you love doing. I want you to do a job to where if, and we work by train, by the way, if you hear that in the background.
Absolutely, that's Ybor City.
That is Ybor City. That is Mr. Plant, H.B. Plant's railroad line, the original one. That's the reason Ybor City is here. So to finish my thought, look, there's some people that think I do this job so that I can then finish my job and get paid. Now I can go out and enjoy my life. I can do my real life. And I have to balance the sacrifice of my job to the benefit of my life. If you're living like that, you're going to be miserable. You're going to be freaking miserable because you're going to be spending the best part of your waking day doing something that's a sacrifice. What kind of life is that? My vote is choose the job that you love to do. And now it's not a sacrifice. This is what I want. My kid, Peanut, in college, he's studying computer science. If I win the lottery or he wins the lottery tomorrow and he never has to go to college and he doesn't, you know what he'll do? He'll wake up in the morning, he'll open his computer, and he'll start learning how to program and learning how to make computers. He'll start doing exactly what he's doing for school now because that's what he loves to do. If I could be any job I wanted, I would have been a race car driver. I'll tell you the truth. That was my intention. I went to law school to make some fast money, and I was going to come back out and put it into a race team and going to probably end up winning the world's Grand Prix championship. That's what I intended. It didn't work out. If it had,
hasn't worked out yet.
Yeah.
you could do that, right?
I had a race car when I turned, I don't remember how old I was, but I quit the race car business whenever I joined the FJA presidency track, that okay. 4 years. So, okay. And it wasn't working out. I'm too fat and my timing's off. But okay. If I could, I would be working on that race car every day, all the time, and I would be digging the heck out of it. And nobody would be coming to me saying, you got to balance how much you're working. I'd be like, get out of my way. I love doing this.
You've got the passion, and that's
and so
that's
find
important.
A job.
Yeah, sure.
Find a profession. Find a thing that you can do, which is what you would be doing if you weren't getting paid for it. And right now, this isn't race car driving, but it's the second best thing.
How important is it to find a mentor? And did you have one?
You know, I didn't have a mentor for a long time, and it was really harsh. I didn't know what I was doing. And what that really means, if you don't have a mentor, there's a lot of late nights in the law library back then. I guess it'd be on a computer today trying to learn what it is that you're promising people that you will do. And that for me, I just spent my weekends grunting it out, learning how to do what, and maybe I made a lot of mistakes. But when Lef came into my life, old man Lef, he became my mentor, him and Bob Mays, and they did really help me understand how to make the law become not a tool, but a weapon. And making the law into a weapon to win for your client, that's a different state of mind. Now,
and you've said you live for the battle. You'd rather lose than
not
contract
fight
law.
100 times. 100 times out of 100, I would.
That's an extraordinary statement.
And at my age, you know, and I say that in the nicest possible way, at my age, the challenge now becomes to live beyond this through the lawyers that I help train. And that becomes some of the most satisfying stuff that I do now. Somebody else has to be the one to do what Lef maybe and Al Cohn did for me.
How did you go about honing your trial skills, though?
Honestly, it's so unglamorous. I attended FJA seminars. I attended Florida Bar seminars as I could afford them. Mind you, there's no like thing that happened that made me rich. I've never hit that $80 million case. It's always been a balance, and so I would go to seminars, and I would try to watch other great lawyers, and I would read transcripts of other people's trials, and I would see how the logistics of it got done. And then from an early stage, I came to believe, and I still do, that if you just be fundamentally honest with your jury and the judge and yourself, if you can shut up and quit being a lawyer for a minute and listen to the honesty in your soul. And that sounds awfully airy and fairy, but I'm telling you that it's in there. Shut up and be quiet and listen to your client and listen to the voice. They will tell you how to win that case. Don't try to act. Don't try to put on a big show. Don't try to put on some case you don't believe is true. You'll lose that every single time. But if you be honest and kind, and you talk to even unfriendly jurors. There's a big move today that we got to pick just the right juror. We got to get rid of all the bad jurors. We got to find them, make them say stuff that we can kick them off. And that's great if you can figure out how to do that. I've never been able to. My view is I want to try this case to the feed store operator. We run a cattle ranch up in Pasco County, my wife and I do. And I'll always go up there to the feed store and talk about my next trial to the guys at the feed store. And if you can't do that, you haven't found your case yet.
Let's talk about running a practice, because that is a challenge for a lot of attorneys who may be good attorneys, but they're not managers, they're not businessmen or businesswomen. It's a difficult profession to begin with, let alone being a lawyer, but to run a law firm. What can you share? Your day-to-day...
Yeah, listen, that is without a doubt. For 10 years, I was a one-lawyer, one-secretary operation, 10 years, and tried a lot of big cases, did a lot of things, and you don't take a vacation, you can't really have a sick day. There's just no room for any of that. It is a miserable business. If there's one thing that I would say that's been my success, it isn't the big verdicts. I've had some great verdicts, cases that we thought we were going to lose. But I've also lost some cases that I felt like we should have won. I think every lawyer that practices a long time and gives the opportunity will get big verdicts. That's great. But the harder part, the part that means more, is building the firm. As a lawyer, you get a big verdict in a case, you can change that client's world. But if you build a law firm that is powerful and strives for excellence, lives excellence, if you build a law firm, you can change the world for everybody. And that's been my aspiration. And if there's one thing I think I've done well, I would say that it's that, building the firm. It's not just hiring a bunch of talented people and putting them in a room and then giving them stuff to work on. That's not going to work. You need to build all the logistics, all the supply line. You need to build all the support staff. You need to build all the marketing stuff. You need to be training your people, training everybody from the paralegals and the secretaries to the young lawyers to the experienced lawyers. You need to be thinking about how to organize them, to put them together to be efficient and effective and win. And by God, I think that that's what we've done here better than anything else, and I'm most proud of that.
Have you created a firm that will survive you?
I hope so. That's a question that everybody asks. There are not many of them, you know. Before advertising, no firms lasted very long. Before advertising, law firms that became big were a collection of big ego lawyers. And so they are going to blow up, right? They're like atoms that are just unstable, and they're going to blow up. With advertising, clients don't know the names of any of the lawyers other than the guy who's doing the commercial, right? They know one or two or three lawyers who are doing the commercials, and everybody else are faceless. So those lawyers are interchangeable. They don't leave. Why should they? And that firm can grow to be however big you want. Now, take advertising out of the picture and keeping a firm together after the founder dies or retires, that becomes a much more difficult proposition.
Yeah, you've lost your big skill set, presumably.
If you let that happen, and the way to make that not happen is to train the next generation of leaders, and that's my focus now. Here's an interesting number. There are 11 lawyers in my firm. Every one of them, except Liz Weibel, started their legal career here. This was their first job. None of them came to us after a defense firm or none of that. We hired them out of law school, and this is where they started. I don't think anybody could say that.
You mentioned advertising, billboards. We certainly see a lot of them. There are complaints about the legal profession that it has become slowly commoditized. What's your view on settling a case versus going to trial?
Well, I don't want to generalize. It's not a moral thing about advertising, and I don't want to create the appearance that I think that it is. Now, the problem is that you get into a model. If your next case is coming to you because of your experience and your reputation, your next case is coming to you because of how you handled this case, you're going to be working a heck of a lot harder on it because you know that your future depends on what you do in this case. If, however, your next case is coming to you because of your marketing program and your advertising, this was going to be an investment that you got to control and manage and just get rid of it whenever you think, maybe not the greatest result for the client, but the one that's most sort of economically viable. And that's, man, I wish I could convince people not to do that. I wish I could convince. We actually, and everybody says, oh, easy for you to say, Swope, you're over here working on these $10 million cases. Of course, you can go to trial and everything, but I'm working on small cases. I get it. I'm going to tell anybody, dude, nobody started smaller than me, and nobody, I have a standing offer of $1,000 to anybody that can demonstrate that they've been broker than I have been. Nobody has been broker than I have been in building this firm. But there are means by which you can afford to try cases, and you will get more for your clients if you do it. And what the hell do you want to be? Do you want to be a trial lawyer, or do you want to be an insurance adjuster with a freaking law degree? Because that's what they'll turn you into. They'll turn you into a lawyer that shuffles around papers and moves things back and forth and kisses up to the insurance company and ends up taking what they're willing to pay you. Is that really what you want? It isn't. You want to be a damn hero. And there's only one place to be a hero. It's in the courtroom. In the courtroom, you don't go in and ask for money. You go in and you take it from them. You don't ask for their permission. You don't ask if they think it's fair. You talk to the jury, who 100% of the time is more generous than the insurance adjuster on the other side of the case. So just be a trial lawyer, and the money will take care of itself. You haven't asked this question, but I'm going to tell you this too. I was on Harbor Island, so it would have been in the 80s, and I had been rich, and I had gotten poor again. That's every trial lawyer knows this cycle. You get rich, and you think finally behind me, and then it's not behind you. All success is transient. Fortunately, all failures are too. And I was coming across the bridge between the parking lot and the office, and I'd felt like everything in my world had collapsed because money had gone again, and I was so damn done with it. I was so beaten and so defeated. And I promised myself at that moment that I was just going to quit thinking about money and I was going to let it take care of itself. I didn't care. I gave myself up to it. I was like, I don't know. You know, if I go bankrupt, I freaking go bankrupt and I don't care. And honest to God, from that moment forward is when I had to kind of quit where money is taking care of itself. Mm-hmm. It's like a magic thing. So I'm not saying money's not important. Money comes in mighty handy when you're trying to run a firm and build a firm. But if you focus on doing really well and doing your best, that money will take care of itself.
Let's talk about the Florida Justice Association. You are a recent past president as we sit here in May of 2019. You were president from 2017 to 2018. There were some big issues involved there. You've been inducted into the Eagle Hall of Fame for your lifetime contributions to the FJA Foundation. You're a regular seminar speaker at the meetings. You're a recipient of the Mickey Smiley Award for mentorship. Dale, how has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
It cannot be overstated. It's you couldn't do it without it. And I don't think you still can do it without it. I mean, I'm going to be honest. And look, there have been times when me and the FJA didn't see things eye to eye. I'll be perfectly straight with you. If you move into the leadership of that organization, you move into the center of it, it's a rough and tumble place. And it's good training for the political experience you're going to need if you become an officer. They're always asking you for money, it feels like, and it feels like you can't say no to them. And it can be harsh. But let me tell you something. Everybody knows that we wouldn't be in business without them. Everybody gets that. Everybody understands the advocacy. But if what you want to be is an actual trial lawyer, you need to learn how to do that, and you can't just get it by osmosis. The FJA is the only place where the top people in the profession come to teach you how to be a trial lawyer. People who are, for whatever reason, willing to give free for them everything that they have developed over a 30-year career. There isn't any place else that you can get that. I do seminars for the Florida Bar, the local bar associations, for anybody, commercial operations. I do a lot of them, but none of them are like the FJA. And so the training programs, the brotherhood that you develop, the ability to be in the local trial lawyer associations, the email distribution list, all those things, I will tell you 100%. Could not have I wouldn't be here. The Tro Perdante wouldn't be here for the FJA.
How important is it to give back?
I think that's a personal decision. Some people seem to be just fine to do it without it. To me, it isn't going to live. The FJA won't survive. We've lost our first generation of founders. All the Alcones and Lefferts maybes and all those old original geniuses who created this organization, they're gone. We're about to lose the second generation of them, people who are maybe a little bit ahead of me. They're reaching the age where they don't deserve to have to work any more than they want to. And then my generation ain't far behind, okay? So if the people who are today taking, because we want you to take more than you give, we want you to take all you want, those people need to remember that they're going to have to reach back and build that bridge for the next generation.
Dale, how do you balance your professional life with your family life? You have a wife and two children.
I have a phenomenal wife. And I have two phenomenal children, and I love every single minute of being with them. I don't try to balance this. I try to integrate it. My wife worked in the law firm until we had our second child. This building that we're in here that has won like a zillion awards, all the design work was done by my wife. We did this together. And My kids have grown up in the practice. My kids didn't know that a vacation, you could go on a vacation that didn't have a bunch of trial lawyers running around, because that's the only vacations that we were able to have for most of their young lives. We'd go out to the retreats and so on like that. They thought that's what a vacation was. And so I work at home, and somebody goes, "Oh my God, you bring your work home." And I'm like, "No, dude, I am at home while I work. I love my work. I love this firm. I love my family. I don't break them apart. They're all integrated, and I love every minute with all of them."
Do you have regrets?
Yeah. I would say that if I wish that I had maybe not tried to grow so fast and so big. I wish that I hadn't aimed for the firm as high as I did, because by doing that, I put a lot of stress on everybody that I love. I going from nothing, which is what I was, my firm was, I didn't have a career, I didn't have any connections, I didn't have any money, I didn't have any friends, I didn't have any cases. Going from dust to building what I believed to be the most excellent firm that I could have ever dreamed to build, that was a magnificently difficult thing to do. And maybe I should have given myself a few more years to do that. That extra pressure probably might have been harder on me, and so I thank God my wife, right? She understood and she put up with me.
Dale, how would you like to be remembered?
It's a tough question. You know, I would like to be remembered as an authentic person. I'd like to be remembered as a person who is honest. Even insurance companies, I want them to know that I will hit them as hard as I can. I'll knock them out, but I'll always hit them above the belt. I want them to know that, I want people to think that if I've had success, I came by it honestly and hard, and it was through work, and it was doing things kind of in an old-fashioned, old-school way. And I want them to know that I was a lawyer. I was a person who loved doing this, okay? This wasn't a sacrifice. This wasn't something that I gave up so I could feel better about myself. I have loved not every minute of it, but I have loved every year of it. And the big pictures of things, my partnership with Angela Redonte that's been going on since she was 17 years old is when I met her. She worked for me when she was a runner, and she's now my partner. I want people to remember, this shit's fun.
Dale Swope, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.